And so on through the Dhanu Rashi, Sagittarius, its course is called Dakshinayana, the southern way. And when the sun enters Makara Rashi, Capricorn, and therefore it travels through Kumbha Rashi, Aquarius, and so on through Mithuna Rashi, Gemini, its course is called Uttarayana, the northern way. When the sun is in Mesha Rashi, Aries, and Tula Rashi, Libra, the duration of day and night are equal. On Manasotra Mountain are the abodes of four demigods. East of Sumeru Mountain is Devapani, where King Indra lives, and south of Sumeru is Samyamuni, the abode of Yamaraj, the superintendent of death. Similarly, west of Sumeru is Nimlochani, the abode of Varuna, the demigod who controls the water, and north of Sumeru is Vivavari, where the demigod of the moon lives. Sunrise, moon, sunset, and midnight occur in all these places because of the movements of the sun. Diametrically opposite the place where the sunrise takes place and the sun is seen by human eyes, the sun will be setting and passing away from human vision. Similarly, the people residing diametrically opposite the point where it is midday will be experiencing midnight. The sun rises and sets with all the other planets headed by the moon and other luminaries. The entire Kalachakra, or wheel of time, is established on the wheel of the sun god's chariot. This wheel is known as Samvatsara. The seven horses pulling the chariot of the sun are known as Gayatri, Vihati, Aushnik, Jilati, Trishtup, Anushtup, and Punkti. They are harnessed by a demigod known as Arunadeva to a yoke 900,000 yojanas wide. Thus the chariot carries Adityadeva, the sun god. Always staying in front of the sun god and offering their prayers are 60,000 sages known as Vailikilyas. There are 14 Gandharvas, Apsaras, and other demigods who are divided into seven parties and who perform ritualistic activities every month to worship the Supersoul through the sun god according to different names. Thus the sun god travels through the universe for a distance of 95,100,000 yojanas, which is 760,800,000 miles, at a speed of 16,004 miles at every moment. So we'll continue reading. So text one. So Shishuku Vacha Ithavaneva Bhu Valayasya Sanivesha Pramana Lakshanato Vyakya Taha. Actually, this first verse we can do the word by word synonyms. Shri Shuku Vacha. Shri Shukadeva Goswami said, Etavan, so much. Eva, certainly. Bhuvalayasya Sanivesha. The arrangement of the whole universe. Pramana Lakshana Taha. According to measurement, 50 crores of yojanas, or 4 billion miles in width and length, and characteristics. Vyakyataha, estimated. Translation, Shukadeva Goswami said, my dear king, I have thus far described the diameter of the universe, 50 crores of yojanas or 4 billion miles, and its general characteristics according to the estimations of learned scholars. So text 2. Etena hi divo mandala manam tadvira upadishanti yatadvi dalaihor anishpavadinam te antarenan tariksham taru boya santitam. As a grain of wheat is divided into two parts, and one can estimate the size of the upper part by knowing that of the lower, so expert geographers instruct, one can understand the measurement of the upper part of the universe by knowing those of the lower part. The sky between the earthly sphere and heavenly sphere is called Antariksha, or outer space. It adjoins the top of the sphere of earth and the bottom of that of heaven. Text 3. Yanmad yukato vagavams tapatam batistapana attapena trilokim pratapatya vabhasayati atma bhasa sahesha udgayanta rakshanayanta vaishuvata samgyabhir manjasai griyaha samanabhir gativir arohana varohana samana stanishu yata savanam abhipadjavanu makaradishu rashishvaho ratrani dirgarashva samanani vedate. In the midst of that region of outer space, Antariksha is the most opulent sun, the king of all the planets that emanate heat, such as the moon. By the influence of its radiation, the sun heats the universe and maintains this proper order. It also gives light to help all living entities see. While passing toward the north, toward the south, or through the equator, in accordance with the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is said to move slowly, swiftly, or moderately. According to its movements in rising above, going beneath, or passing through the equator, and correspondingly coming in touch with various signs of the zodiac, headed by Makara Capricorn, days and nights are short, long, or equal to one another. So, purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Lord Brahma prays in his Brahma Sahita in the 5th chapter, text 52. Yat chakshuresha savita sakala grahanam raja samasta suramurti asesha teja yashogya brahmati samrita kala chakro govindamadi purusham tamaham bhajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, under whose control even the sun, which is considered to be the eye of the Lord, rotates within the fixed orbit of eternal time. The sun is the king of all planetary systems and has unlimited potency in heat and light. Although the sun is described as Bhagavan, the most powerful, and although it is actually the most powerful planet within the universe, it nevertheless has to carry out the order of Govinda, Krishna. The sun god cannot deviate even an inch from the orbit designated to him. Therefore, in every sphere of life, the supreme order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is carried out. The entire material nature carries out his orders. However, we foolishly see the activities of material nature without understanding the supreme order and the supreme person behind them. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Maya Dyakshena Prakriti, material nature carries out the orders of the Lord, and thus everything is maintained in an orderly way. So, Om Gana Timiranda Shaganjana Shrakaya Chaksur Unmiritam Yena Tasmai Shi Gurave Namaha. So, in this chapter, in the previous chapters, we've been hearing elaborate descriptions of the universal affairs. This chapter is dedicated to the sun. And those of us who were raised in the West, we become a little incredulous hearing some of these descriptions. Because in the West, you know, we've basically been taught something called the heliocentric conception. And previous to that, before Galileo, of course, they had this geocentric conception, which is basically what's being mentioned here. Geocentric, of course, for those of you who don't know what that means, it means the earth is the center, and in the heliocentric, helios refers to the sun, so the sun is the center. So, I mean, any of us have gone to school here, all of us have gone to school, actually, we learn that there's the sun, and then there's Mercury, and then and then the Earth, Mars. You know, Mars is the Martian planet. And finally, after all is said and done, at least it used to be, you get to Pluto, right? Now they don't accept Pluto anymore. Poor Pluto's been rejected as a planet. And he's just considered like a puny little nothing. He's not qualified to be a planet, right? So that was what we learned. You know, and we saw so many models, and we went to the Hayden Planetarium. Anyone's heard of the Hayden Planetarium? New York, yeah. And they had this big projector, and you sit there and go, wow. It was like, actually it was like this room here. That's why I built a temple like this after the Hayden Planetarium. So you go, wow, go to outer space, and visit this planet or that planet and see. So here we're reading something that really apparently contradicts everything we've learned, and you know, everything the scientists have measured using their instruments, and you know, and telescopes, and you can corroborate basically through just through using telescopes and measurements what the scientists say. So, what are we going to do with all this information? Is the question. Well, movement happens to be relative, so even the explanation according to the geocentric concept is correct. Because in outer space, you basically don't have a frame of reference like we have here on the Earth. I mean, movement is always taken in terms of a frame of reference. I mean, for example, you can say, let's say there's a little ant walking across the floor. We can say the ant is moving at 0.003003 miles an hour. Something like that, you can make that. According to our frame of reference. But let's say, according to another frame of reference, someone's standing in outer space, and the ant happens to be moving in the opposite direction of the Earth's rotation, then they will say the ant is moving in a negative direction. You understand? Because it's just a frame of reference that determines how you measure movement. I mean, it's just common sense. It's common sense. I mean, for example, let's say you drive, another example is, let's say you're driving a car, you're going 60 miles an hour down the road. So, you ask someone in the back to hand you a, hand you some water, because you're thirsty, you're driving a car. So, from the person who's stationary on the road, the water is moving at the rate of, let's say, 61 miles an hour. But from your perspective as a driver, it's moving at the rate of maybe 1 mile an hour. Because if it was moving at 60 miles an hour, you know, it would probably smash all the windows in the car. You know, you wouldn't be able to receive the water. So it's all relative. I mean, motion is all relative to the person who's perceiving it. And especially in outer space, I mean, like, you basically can pick your own frame of reference. You know, you could pick your frame of reference from the moon, you could pick your frame of reference from the Earth, you could pick it from the sun, or just like stand there as one of the geocentric satellites in outer space, you know, geostationary satellites that just remain over the Earth at a particular location. It's interesting. They remain because they rotate at the same rate that the Earth rotates. And that's basically how we have this, you know, the communications through the geocentric, especially if you're interested in watching satellite TV. The satellite dish always remains in the same location, at least if you just have one type of satellite TV. I mean, that's another subject matter we can bring up in a second. But let's say you subscribe. What's the name of a satellite TV company? Dish One or something like that. I mean, it's not that your dish moves. It just stays stationary because the satellite appears to be stationary. Although it's not stationary from another frame of reference. It's moving at the same rate that the Earth is turning. Or from another frame of reference, it is stationary and the sun is going. So it just, It's a question of just relative motion. Of course, just to add a little bit of scientific knowledge, they do have satellite dishes that move. When I was young, my father had one because he wanted to go to pick up information from different satellites. He was stationary. He had a computer-controlled motion sensor, whatever it was, and he would just push a button and he'd go to Sat 1, Sat 2, Sat 3. And this way, he had thousands of different channels he could watch. He was ecstatic. So, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, you could watch channels from India and learn Hindi. It'd be very interesting. So, getting back to the point. So therefore, you know, both the scientists and the Bhagavatam explanations are correct from different frames of reference. Where the scientists are not correct is in the Siddhanta. See, this is the real point here. You know, why is all this information being presented here? It's for the purposes of Siddhanta. I mean, Bhagavatam doesn't present information for the purpose of just scintillating your scientific sense of knowledge. Bhagavatam presents information so you can come to the conclusion. Siddhanta means basically perfect conclusion, if you take apart that word. Siddha means perfection. It's like Susan would perform Siddha yoga before you join the movement, right? But you didn't achieve perfection. And anta means conclusion or the end. Yeah. Antagatam papam, just like the verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Yesham twantagatam papam. Now when one comes to the end of performing sinful activities, finishes performing sinful activities. So the word sananta means a perfect eternal conclusion. So that's really the point of all these verses. Not that one should spend their time drawing little diagrams and graphs. I mean, devotees did that. You know, and I was just thinking, what a waste of time. I mean, even with the temple of Vedic Planetarium, devotees spent so much money and time trying to figure out, you know, how to make the planetarium model within the temple of Vedic Planetarium. So much time. Eventually, they actually are getting a projector so they can entertain people and make a lot of money by entertaining people, showing big pictures of the universe. So what I told them, you know, the research committee, because they didn't come to any conclusion, which is interesting. You had on one hand, you had Dhanavir Maharaj, who was presenting his book, trying to show everybody one point of view. I don't know, and he even published books on that. And then on the other hand, you had people who were taking a more Siddhantic approach, you know, what is the purpose of it all? I mean, the teleological approach. You know, teleology means purposes, the study of purposes. Just showing why do you have these different levels in the universe, which is actually much more important. I mean, you have Brihad Bhagavatamrita describes, you know, what happens in different places. And it's not so important, you know, how it's structured or how far away each place is. I mean, of course, Gopal Kumar, he was able to travel by chanting the Gopal mantra. He didn't worry about, you know, distances or, what is that called in Star Trek? Warp 5 or something like that. Or Beam Me Up Scotty or any of that. You know, poor Gopal Kumar, you know, let's put our Gopal mantra on Warp 6. Wouldn't it work? So he's the end of the Gopal mantra. And he was transported to different places, and ultimately he was even transported to a place you couldn't get to by space travel or any type of material travel, which is the spiritual world. You know, he went through all these different coverings of the material universe, each 10 times thicker than the previous covering. So, but the point is, what happened in each place? You know, what's happening? What's the reason for each of those places? What's the purpose of each of those places? You know, so Gopal Kumar went to Siddhaloka, he went to Brahmaloka, and the technology was not important, other than chanting the Gopal mantra, or the distances were not important, but the conclusion was important. So when we were discussing how to structure the trouble the Vedic planetarium. That was my opinion. I said, you know, why are you spending all your time going through all these old books? You'll never understand these things. Because that's another reason why these descriptions are given. These descriptions are given because you'll never understand them. You come to the conclusion that it's just completely achincha. It's just like systems energy. I mean, just like the scientists now are trying to understand what's happening in the, you know, subatomic world. Atomic world means the atom. Subatomic means, you know, what's happening underneath it all. So, of course, I keep up with this because it happens to be one of my means of sense gratification, to study science, and that's what I was doing before doing the Hare Krishna movement. So, you know, they come up with, they bombard the atom, and they come up with the God particle, which is named after a nice Indian man, anyway. So, and then after that they figure, well, maybe it's all just strings where that are vibrating. You know, they come up with these amazing theories. And I'm not decrying any of the particular theories, they're just interesting. And maybe it's just like vibrating strings of energy that are causing all this. And then yesterday I was reading about antimatter. It was really interesting. Prabhupada even talks about antimatter in the Indian Journey of the Planet. But he uses that as a bridge to talk about Krishna consciousness, which is the real use of antimatter. He's dovetailing antimatter in Krishna's service. So they were talking about antimatter, so they come up with one particle of antimatter. And basically, they have to suspend it in a vacuum. Because if antimatter comes in touch with matter, guess what happens? Kaboom. You know, they're both destroyed. I mean, there's a little particle of antimatter. I don't know how they got it, you know. Maybe they went to the antimatter factory and constructed it or something. They say it's antimatter. I don't know if it is. I mean, they say it's antimatter. They're not even sure it's antimatter. Yeah. No, it could be. It could be. Prabhupada said there was antimatter. You know, so it's, you know, scientists can do so many things. We're not saying that they're completely off. Their conclusion is off that there's no God, but that's no God. So anyway, so they have this suspended, and then they're gonna, take off the suspension, somehow it's magnetic suspension or electromagnetic suspension, and take off the suspension to determine that the antimatter also has anti-gravity. In other words, to see if it falls down or goes up. It's interesting. I mean, don't blame me. It's my one sense gratification I have as a sannyasi. It's not breaking the principles. So, you know, I just, what can I say? You know, I get excited when I talk to Rasaraj, who's our scientist, you know, causing me like symptoms of ecstasy to come up my body. Everybody has their own sense, legal sense gratification. You like to eat, I like to hear science. So anyway, I always wanted to work for the Bhaktivedanta Institute, but they didn't take me. Antimatter. So anyway, the more scientists, the point I'm making is the more scientists get into it, the more complexity they discover. In fact, you know, let's talk about biology, for example. They can't even understand the complexity or understand how a cell is going on. You know, DNA and RNA. I mean, you know, finally they've sequenced DNA. You know, sequenced it. In other words, they understand the whole human sequence of DNA. They can identify if someone has some birth defect or something like that according to the DNA. They don't understand how it works. Why does it work? You know, why does that little DNA make RNA, you know, who's the brains behind? You know, they think it's all happening by chance, which is kind of stupid. If you think of, you know, these little tiny DNA and RNA messengers coming from DNA, you know, messengers. They even call it messengers. Messengers is sort of like anthropomorphic conception. But it's, you know, RNA is what transmits the DNA information. So the DNA is able to carry out its function. And also that's influenced by your psychology too. I mean, which is basically they can be bewildered by this too. That whatever your psychology is, it influences which DNA, which genes are expressed, and which genes are not expressed. I mean, it's so not only complex, but unless you bring a personal understanding, you know, a personal director into the whole thing, or design into the whole thing, it's just like, huh? You got like a whole city in each, I mean, bigger than New York, I mean, more complex than New York City in each cell, right? Unlimitedly more complex in each cell, and you know, the DNA is moving around, giving the RNA messages, and it's all happening according to how you're thinking, and somehow your thinking is influencing the cell. How is that going on? Did your thoughts influence what's happening in the cells in your fingernail or your blood or whatever? And it, you know, and many diseases, of course. We were talking about this yesterday. Like if someone gets very depressed, they get Parkinson's disease because they don't have enough L-DOPA, which, you know, is a whole thing. So many diseases come from psychological states, or at least get worse or get cured because of different psychological states. And nobody understands how that's working. And the more scientists look into it, the more damn complex it becomes. It's just bewildering. And then to try to understand what consciousness is, that's, you know, they go all the way to the subatomic level and all these different things. And then consciousness, what's that? And they just have this fancy word for it. They just say it's an epiphenomenon of matter. Instead of saying it comes from matter, they have to come up with a fancy word. Because without fancy words, nobody would believe them. If they just use common English. I mean, I discovered that in the university, not only in the science field, but in the philosophy field and everything like that. You really have to use fancy words to impress people. If you just like use common English, say, well, it's just, you know, consciousness comes from matter. I say, no, it doesn't. But if you say, it's an epiphenomenon of matter, they say, oh, it sounds interesting, isn't it? That's the way the scientists, they use these big words just so that people will believe them. They say, Kali Yuga, it's described in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto, that if you can juggle words, you're considered intelligent. That's actually a direct description of the symptoms of Kali Yuga. You're considered intelligent. Anyway, so one of the purposes of all this description, all these descriptions, is to help you understand that you'll never understand it. You know, that's just basically it. You know, why draw up all these charts and everything like that? Basically, you'll understand the teleology. When it says that Yasmin Vigate Sarvam Evam Vigatam Bhavati, that's an interesting statement. That one who knows Krishna knows everything. Because he knows the purpose of everything. Prabhupada talked about that too. He said, just like in a car, he said, I may not know how the engine's working, but I know how to use it. So what's important? I mean, is it higher to be the mechanic who knows how to change spark plugs? Or the person who owns the car? I mean, who's better? And drives the car? Or even better if you have a chauffeur. That's not a Jewish form. Happy Passover, or whatever. So, so what's higher? The highest is, you know, you just sit in the car and get driven around. And you know, you just pay a mechanic to figure it out. And Prabhupada said, that way you know a car. Because you know how to use it properly. So that's really one who, that's why when we say, a devotee who knows Krishna knows everything. Or a pure devotee knows everything. It's not that every pure devotee knows how to fix a car. Not that you go, you know, you're having trouble with your plumbing in your house and you go to your guru. I said, Guru Dave, could you tell me where the leak is? You know, huh? Or maybe he can tell you, but maybe he brings out his witch sticks and, you know, just like, tells you where the leak is, but no. He tells you, you fool, call a plumber. It's like, Prabhupada told that story about, you know, Henry Ford, who was being accused of being less intelligent. And he was suing someone, or someone was suing him. He went to court. And he said, basically his evidence he presented in court was that he said, "Your Honor, see this row of buttons? If I push this button, this technologist comes running. So who's more intelligent?" You understand? Someone who could push a button and he doesn't have to waste his time learning all this technological garbage. That's more intelligent. In other words, a businessman is more intelligent. Like Prabhupada said, technology is like shudra activity. And Vaishya, you know, businessman is Vaishya. So Vaishya is higher than a shudra, right? And even higher than that is a kshatriya. Because a kshatriya doesn't have to worry about making money. He just, you know, the Vaishyas have to pay him taxes. Higher than that is a Brahmin, because he doesn't worry about money. Because Krishna's taking care of him. And he, you know, if he has it, he has it. If he doesn't, it's just Krishna. So, anyway, so one who knows the purpose of everything knows everything. Or how to utilize everything knows everything. So this is the point of this description. Several points. One is, it's infinitely complex. Second point is, the most important point is, Krishna's in control of everything. And the third point is, therefore use it for Krishna. He's the owner. Isha Vasham Idam Sarvam Yakancha Jagajam Jagat Tena Chaktena Bunjita Magadha Krishna Svitam. Everything is only controlled by the Supreme Lord. Also, in other words, Om Purnamada Purnamidam. It's the material world's a complete unit. It emanates from the complete whole, right? It's a complete unit. And Krishna, like it was mentioned yesterday, Krishna's not only the prime mover, but he's also imminent. He's in everything too. He's controlling everything. He's not like, you know, Aristotle's prime mover. He just kicked everything, like the person who throws the first baseball into the, you know, the president in the baseball season. He's just in charge of everything. So everything is controlled by Krishna. That's what Prabhupada says here at the end, of course. The entire material nature carries out his orders. However, we foolishly see the activities of material nature without understanding the supreme order and the supreme person behind them. This is the real point. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Maya Jakshana Prakriti, material nature carries out the orders of the Lord, and thus everything is maintained in an orderly way. And so, just the final point is, when something happens to you, or with you, that's Krishna. In other words, it didn't happen by accident. And there's something you're supposed to learn. There's a purpose to it. There's a purpose in everything. There's a purpose why someone yelled at you. There's a purpose why you got sick. Of course, unless it was your own fault that you didn't wear a coat when you went out or something like that. I mean, obviously we can't blame Krishna for every single negative thing that happens to us that could have been under our control. But for things that are outside of our control, there's a reason these things happen. Instead of just lamenting, you know, feeling yourself a victim, and I just had a realization, because someone I know, he was victimized like 50 years ago or something like that for some reason. And now he's taking it out on his wife. You know, he's just like yelling at her. You know, he's like 92 or 93 right now. And he's yelling at her, and I just asked him, why are you cursing at your wife all the time? Because I was treated unfairly in this world. But she never treated you unfairly. So it's like that, you know, we have this victim mentality. And then, so we should understand, whatever happened before, that was Krishna. Krishna was teaching us something. You know, if someone did something, acted harshly, there's a lesson to be learned. Of course, ultimately the lesson is, you take shelter in Krishna's names. Don't sit around feeling sorry for yourself. Anyway, so these are, I can speak more about it, but we don't have any more time. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, especially here. You know, members of the Krishna Conscious Movement, we have we've been given coverage association. That's true. Thank you for that point. And we're living in America. I mean, Just speaking to someone last night, they were complaining their house is too small. You know, 1,400 square foot house. And I was thinking, you know, in India, people live in these little tiny houses. I mean, America, we're so fortunate. And actually, the greatest fortune is to have the Association of Shinkalpa. I mean, even if everything else goes wrong, and it may, we're still very fortunate. We're extremely fortunate. We should count our blessings.